Welcome to the Journey Onwards series. So the Journey Onwards or TJO series is a chance for me and all those listening to get to go on that same journey that my family members went through growing up and leaving Africa up until the present day and, you know, everything in between. So today I'm genuinely very excited to be speaking with Upin Datani, one of my generation of cousins who was actually born in East Africa, but I'll leave him to tell you more about that. But the reason I'm so excited for today's conversation is, Upin, you've always been, you know, incredibly fun and engaging, whether it's through conversations that we've had in the past. Your general storytelling and wit, it's always, you've had the ability to relate and get on with the younger and older generations. And I've also had some insightful chats directly with you. So whether it's about work or what's happening in the world or life in general. And even when I got back from China, you always checked up on me. I appreciated that. But I'd like to start at the beginning and tell me about your childhood and where you grew up.
Actually, one thing that you mentioned there, Anand, and thanks, that was a good intro. One thing you mentioned about getting on with different generations. I've always seen myself as a bit of sort of in between the generations. I don't know if other people or everyone feels that, but I see that a lot, particularly because, like now, when I speak to Prakash uncle, Ashwin uncle, partly because of the time when we first came to UK, but partly because the way they are, they're young-hearted anyway. I've always called Ashwin uncle and Prakash uncle, like what most of us do. But we regard each other as, you know, we can go out for a beer, and that's been the case for many, many years. But also, on the other hand, I remember you when you were a tiny kid. Yeah. I remember Sima, Nita especially, and Sanjay and people like that. So I see myself as in the middle, which sometimes is a bit of a, you know, where am I? But also there's an advantage because I get almost the best of both sides there. So I think it's worth mentioning that I've seen both sides, but I also remember Bayan Bapuji. Yeah. And of course, now we've got the other end of the spectrum for Ray and people like that, who is my equivalent, being the eldest, the Thani boy. So I have a sort of special connection with him. He doesn't know that yet, but he will do.
But do you think with the point you mentioned around the uncles, do you think that's also part of their ability to relate to us? You know, the way I see the uncles as well, I can talk to them like peers. I still respect them, but I don't have to see them as adults. And even the kind of conversations and jokes that I share with them, do you think that plays part into why we're always able, or you are always able, to speak to them like that?
Definitely. I mean, I think for me, it started when we first came to this country. And Ashwin uncle particularly sort of took me under his wing. So, for instance, my taste in music is based heavily on Motown, and so much so. I remember a time when, because Ashwin's uncle was in the shop, and you know, from school, I'd come to the shop with Dad, and I'd go to school, and I'd come back, and again I was in the shop, and me and I used to help him out in the store because that was his sort of area. So we had the radio there, and he used to just talk to me about music, you know. Like, one of the first things he got me into, actually, I'll say Motown, but it was all sort of good music, you know. It had to be class music. So one of the first things he got me into introduced me to Simon and Garfunkel. And, I mean, to this day, whenever that song, you know, you stop and you listen to it, because it's just incredible. But then came Motown, and it got to a stage where, apart from very few exceptions, if I mentioned something and it wasn't Motown, I'd stop because, no, I'm going to get a sort of, you know, a proper telly that said, well, we only listen to Motown and it very much was like that. And I'm very grateful for that, because I think, now my music is very eclectic, and I can say to both that, oh yeah, we like this and we like that. And Sutton's music from the start he's always had his own thing anyway.
Yeah.
And I used to say to him, you know, why are you listening to Cockney Rebel, Steve, you know, Harley and people like that? And he'd say, well, it's good, that's what I like. And he always had that thing, so I could never get him to completely subscribe to our Motown club, you know. But now I see that, you know, it's grown. But that because I had that relationship with Ocean Uncle, so I think that has nurtured into a relationship where as soon as I could drink, you know, we'd have a drink. But also there were times when, you know, he'd give me advice, he'd say stuff, you know, that maybe was difficult or that was easier for him to say than my parents. So there was that time, but it very quickly grew into a very easy and a comfortable relationship.
I'd like to get further into that, but just to take it one step back, so to your childhood and actually growing up in East Africa, what was that like?
That was, you know what, that was fantastic. We had a big joint family living under one roof. It was great for a kid, for a young kid. It was fantastic because I think it's possible that there was never a time when we didn't have guests there. But that was the way of Ginger. People would turn up at 2 a.m. in the morning. You know, mum tells me, said, oh, yeah, I remember when sons, you know, we'd all gone to bed. There was a knock on the door. We turned up and it was four. This is Santa Feba's husband. And they were traveling from where they lived in Kimlili, I think, to somewhere. Ginger was on the way. So it was natural that they stopped, saying, you know, we're going to stop here. We're going to stop for the night, 1 or 2 days. And everyone would get up. They would make sak and rotli because it's guests, you know. So that's the way it was. But during especially holiday time, like I remember Harsha, Nisha, who's actually not a cousin, she's like an aunt, but she's always been considered as a cousin, or, you know, known her very well. Krutika, people like that, of Lina and Oni were there with us anyway. But for a kid, it was fantastic because it was all under one roof, one big joint family. We had the business there. We were living behind. We also had the house in Nalufenia, which I don't remember living in too much because I was quite young then. So my memories of Ginger is just a big family with lots of people to care for you and to entertain you, basically. I remember in Ginger, the days were busy mornings. Mm-hmm. So everything ready for the shop. In the house, there was cooking going on for lunchtime because we used to shop. The shop used to shut at lunch. So there was cooking going on. And in the afternoons were very boring because Ginger used to shut down for a couple of hours. So for a kid, right, it was like, you know, well, what do I do now? And that's when I remember I've got some great memories of Sobufe. Used to sort of, you know, if I wasn't asleep, she'd just take me to a room and she'd read comics to me. So Beano, Dandy and comics like that. And that's a great memory to have, to have that sort of thing. I remember Mai and Bapuji were very, very much the head of the family. Bapuji, I've got some very, very clear memories. Whenever all the images I have of Bapuji are very warm, caring, protective figure. And he had a calmness about him, you know, certainly for a kid. And I always, you know, it was like whenever he was around, you always felt comfortable. I mean, he was very much a central figure in the Luana community in Ginger. And anyone who lived in Ginger during that time, they would definitely know Bremji Baidotani.
Yeah, this is what I hear a lot of this. And it's one of the reasons that I wanted to create this series to find out a lot more, because I fortunately never had the chance to meet him. But do you think that the way you described him, is that something that was his persona with everyone? Was it mainly just family, or did he kind of have this caring and giving attitude to everyone that he knew?
I think that, I mean, he was generally a kind, warm and smiling person. I can't picture him without a smile. But he was, like, for instance, I think he was on the board of governors or something like that for the local boarding school. So he was a figure of authority there.
Yeah.
I mean, someone may have to correct me on that. I could probably find out from mum. But it was, I know he was connected with the boarding school there. It may have been the Kissimmee one. So there was the authoritative side of him there as well. But also, I mean, you know, he was head of a large family. So there was that side of him, but the caring part was very much there. It was a happy household, and that's what I remember. I miss it desperately every day. You can't you can't put that sort of away. You can't put that behind you. And we had Ba as the sort of a matriarch. She was always fussing over kids. Mum tells me that she'd take me to the mandir, and if it was hot, you know, she'd carry me and she'd take a sadlon and put it over my head to protect me from the sun. Life in Jinja was, I miss it desperately, because there was a certain sort of, it wasn't a clinical place. It was small enough. People knew each other. Certainly race, color, creed, you know, this thing that we have now. Mm-hmm. In Jinja, when it was Eid, for instance, we'd get invited to our Muslim friends to celebrate Eid. When it was Diwali, they would come over. That thing was never there. It was a happy place, you know. My best memories of Jinja, I think one of them has to be Diwali, where in the evening all the shops would open, which is unusual. They'd stay open late in the evening. Everyone would come in to greet each other with Salam Mubarak and Diwali and all that sort of thing. And there'd be Indian mithai everywhere, you know. So we'd do that. And the town was a buzz. Obviously, there's fireworks and stuff like that. Everyone used to get dressed up in the glad rags and go out. That is one of the nicest memories that I have of Jinja. And the other one, obviously, is, well, not obviously, but Dad was a member of Jinja Club. So he used to like playing squash and tennis. And that was a place where I could go, and I'd swim all day if I could there. I was learning to swim. I think I learned to swim just a few days before we came here, right, where I could actually swim unaided. But that was in the evening. We would either go to the pier where Mum and Dad could sort of take a walk and just chat and stuff like that. Me and Satin would take our bikes there, so we'd be riding around there. And then we'd probably go for a drink at the Jinja Club. And it was just a nice, lovely atmosphere where there's, you know, my friends were there. So my recollection of Jinja, I have some very clear memories, but I think it's where you're born, there's an attachment with your heart that doesn't break. For me, it's so, so strong.
You mentioned going, Mum and Dad would go for a walk and you'd go swimming and, you know, out on the pier. What was safety like? Was there ever a fear of parents letting their children wander around at a young age by themselves?
Not when we were there. It was unheard of. I think the concept didn't even occur to me, because I used to walk to school. I used to walk in the mornings, I think. Oh, no, well, we had like Aya, which is the lady that looked, she looked after, so the same Aya looked after me and Satin and Lina and Ami.
Okay.
Yes. So sometimes she'd take us to school. She'd drop us there. Sometimes we'd just walk there. I mean, I was a sort of 7, 8, 9 year old kid, because you'd go past people's houses and they'd say hello up in, you know, how are you? The chat. Every house knew you. You know, they knew the family. It was that sort of an atmosphere. It was just like one massive family. Mm. So certainly no problems there. I would jump to go back there. I've been back there once. Obviously, it was different. I see pictures of it on Facebook and stuff like that. And every time I see it, there's a certain twang that there's a pull. And it's because I was born there and I remember it, you know. I remember red dirt, red soil. You know, you miss that sort of thing. You take it for granted when you're there. I remember fantastic weather and friends and the Nile and the school, and, you know, so... For me, it's a wonderful place, almost magical. School was fantastic because, for instance, we all went, all four of us went to the same kindergarten, which was run by a German lady called Helma Cholera, who was married to Vinubai Cholera. Okay. So Auntie Helma, as she was always known, she delivered me, Satin, Lina and Ani, I believe. We all went to a kindergarten. And also, I think one of the differences there from here is that our parents socialized with the teachers. Okay. So the teachers came to the shop, and also Dad would have a drink or play squash or tennis with the teachers. So if there was any trouble at school, it got back home within 24 hours. And as far as parents were concerned, means that if the teachers had to have a go at you, that means you did something wrong. So yeah. You have to explain to us as well. So it was definitely double trouble. And I remember Helma Cholera, if she was in the shop and we found out she was in the shop, we would suddenly start to behave because she had some sort of authority over us. Yeah.
What was schooling like apart from that, comparing it, I guess, to schooling here? I imagine it was quite different.
I think it was tougher here.
Okay.
But there it was, we all went to Victoria Nile, which was easily the best school. I say best in inverted commas. The standard of education there was very, very high, certainly in Victoria Nile. It was an English-speaking school. Most teachers, I would say 80% of the teachers there were English. There were, I would imagine, they're probably the best of teachers from here had gone over there. So the standard was very high. Teaching was, I guess we were all into learning. You had to be. It was like a private school because of the relationship that parents had with teachers. You couldn't mess about. You couldn't get away with it because your parents would say, what are you doing? In fact, they did have to pay for school. It was a private school.
Okay.
So great memories. I learned a lot. I know, for instance, well, I actually remember that I got 38% in maths once, and that came down. I remember the thing that the teacher was Mr. Sabaton. I got 38%. I remember Dad reading the report, and he basically said, "Well, we can't have this. Mm-hmm. You can't be getting 38% in maths." The next day, I was enrolled to have tuition with Mr. Solanke, Arthur Solanke, who taught my mum. Right. And the reason I'm telling you this is because that had such a major influence on my life. That one failure in maths, Mr. Solanke instilled a love for mathematics in me. He had a way of teaching. I mean, at first it was like the worst thing ever, because that means that, I don't know, two or three days after school, or I think it may have been every weekday after school, I'd get dropped to Mr. Solanke's for 2 hours of maths tuition. But that man managed to have put this love of mathematics in me that I ended up doing my degree in maths when I got here. And I loved it from that moment on. So it was that you couldn't get away with much. If you're lagging in something, parents got to know about it, and something was done about it very quickly, you know. So it was still fun. I guess what I'm trying to say there, it was good. It was very good.
Yeah, that's something that I found within our family. You know, there's always been quite a bit of importance on education, along with having a very fun and connected family and getting along and doing fun and sports. Education has always played a major role. Do you think that's something that was instilled by Aba and Bapuji, or where do you think that push and desire for the siblings and kids to do well in education has come from?
I think certainly for me, Dad was always a very, very keen academic. I think he had his heart set on law in the young days, and he would have gone for it. But we have to remember that the responsibility of the family and the business was put on his lap suddenly overnight, literally, because Bapuji, I think it was 66, I may have been wrong there, but it was mid 60s when Bapuji passed away. I actually remember the day, but the next day, Bapuji, it was very sudden. It was over a couple of days.
Yeah.
So suddenly, Dad had the responsibility of the business. And it was a big shop we had there. We had, we used to sell everything from fresh fruit, drinks, canned confectionery, the whole lot. And he had the responsibility of that. And the siblings, you know, for instance. So for him, he had to make sure that he, Ba, and must have been thinking, well, you know, I think Vinunkul was married then, so Ashwin uncle, Prakash uncle, your dad, Minafay, Sobufay, that all became part of the responsibility. Dad had to give up his ambitions then, as I know other brothers have had to when things have happened. But I think because of that, he always made sure that I had that opportunity.
Yeah.
So when we came here, for instance, you know, we had the shop, and I guess at one stage, in the back of my mind, it was like, yeah, you know, I can just go and work in, you know, I'll go in dad's shop. And I think he told me that once. He said, look, if you want to do that, it's there, but I suggest you don't. Yeah. Make the most of, get to university, yeah. And then you can decide. So it was dad had a brilliant way of helping me decide in that way. So the education thing was always there. It was never in your face. Yeah. It was always like, you know, you'd enjoy it. But by the time I came here, I loved maths. That was something that I always wanted to do. So I didn't need much pushing. You know, I enjoyed it at school. I fell into it sort of university, and it worked out well.
What a turn of events from the 38% then.
Yeah, yeah.
How did it come about leaving Jinja?
I mean, that was sudden, actually, because I actually remember now that dad came to school. I think it was afternoon.
Yeah.
Dad suddenly turned up at one of our classes, and I thought, oh no, the first thing is, like, I was trying to think, what have I done wrong? Because that means that he's either here to have a proper go at me. It hadn't happened, but, you know, panic sets in. But he had this worried look on his face, and I straight away I thought there's something wrong. He had a quiet word with the teacher, and he said, come on up in. I just went in his car, said, what's going on, Dad? He goes, I'll tell you soon. He goes, just, you know, don't worry. We're just going home. You're going to have a short day. And I could see places in the town closing, literally, as we drove past, shops were closing. But I also remember, I think the thing I remember, which is the saddest thing, is there were kids in my class who belonged to the tribes of the present at the time, Obote. And they ran. I actually saw them running out of school. They were running for their lives because they realized that this guy had taken over. Obote had been overthrown, and they're in danger. Because
so they knew, did they know that if this event happened where Idi Amin took power, that they were in a troubled or dangerous position?
Yeah, because he'd been sort of posturing quite, you know, he'd been, something was going to happen. It had been simmering up to the coup.
Mm.
I remember actually seeing a couple of these African guys, kids in my class, actually running out of school. So, you know, it was bad enough for us because we didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But it was a major contrast because after Bapuji passed away, okay, it was a shock for Dad and at the time it was Dad, Vinonkel, and Prakashonkel, and Jinja. Ashwin uncle and your dad were in here making, sort of building a life here.
Yeah.
And they'd bought the business up. They'd worked hard and the business was doing all right. So going from that to a sudden shock where we don't know what's going to happen. There's all these rumors about, are we going to get kicked out? Are we safe? Now the safety thing kicked in from overnight to from one extreme to another, literally, where we suddenly were not allowed out. Me and Satin were not allowed outside the gates of our sort of house. So we had the shop and then this sort of yard, we called it Sakati. I think that could be a Swahili word. And then we had the shop behind. We were allowed in the Sakati and then not outside because the army guys, you know, we'd hear gunfire every day and you sort of got used to that. There was a curfew. And that was a strict curfew. I mean, you get caught outside and you could end up paying the ultimate price for that. So that was quite a dramatic end to that. And that didn't last very long. I don't remember much about it. I remember a couple of occasions. Something used to have this, I remember once, this massive army guy, walked into our yard, and he was holding Satin's hand. Satin was a kid at the time, and everyone just froze in the family and thought Satin's either thrown something at this guy or he said something to him, and we're going to have to do some pleading here. Sutton was as calm as anything. And mum or dad said to him, like, Sutton, Sucha, what's the matter? He goes, I'm sorry, he just wanted to use the toilet. You know, so he got his hand. This guy was massive.
How old was Sutton then?
Sutton would have been about 4 or 5, I would imagine, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's been about 5-ish, yeah. But to him, this was completely all right. But when your parents see, when mum and dad saw him, suddenly, you know, this guy was huge. And he had a gun. He was, everyone, they're all army personnel, were armed. And he's holding Sutton's hand. We're thinking, we think the worst, that he's come here to, you know, there's going to be some horrible trouble.
Mm.
So it went bad very, very suddenly. And I remember, I think dad sort of got wise well before a lot of other people, a lot of other Indians there. I think they lived in the hope that it's all going to be all right. I think dad and the brothers realized quite quickly that it's not going to be all right. I don't think this is going to resolve itself. I think we do need to go, and we might as well make whatever plans we can. So luckily, your dad being here, and he'd been here for quite a while, and Ushin uncle being here, we were able to make some plans. So I believe I think dad said, we'd been sending money here anyway. And dad said to Dinesh uncle, we're going to need a business soon. So, you know, look out for one. Obviously, grocery is the obvious one. Look out for one. If you see something good, buy it. You know, we've got them, whatever money we've sent there. Do what you can. Just buy it. Get it ready. And then uncle put that plan in action. And he phoned up and he said, yeah, we've got one. There's a shop here.
Oh, amazing.
That was the one in Barking. He goes, we can do that. And that put the plan in action in Ginger to say, right, so dad was going to come over here. We were going to come over here, start the business going. And that left Prakash uncle and Vinu uncle back in Ginger to wrap things up and get over to UK as soon as possible. So I remember leaving Ginger. I remember the actual time when, like, my mummy and people, they came to say goodbye to us, and they were all crying. To me, it was like, why are they crying? You know, we're going on a plane.
Yeah.
This is exciting. You know, well, we're going on a plane. That was like, what is there to cry about? Yeah, this is really silly. And I tell you, when it hit me, there's something I have to mention. It wouldn't be complete without him. It's Fluffy.
Okay.
Right? Our white Labrador. And it's really weird, but I think about Fluffy, if not, I don't know, it's so weird because he was such a lovable dog, right? Prakash uncle was the closest to him because he used to take him for walks. I mean, Fluffy was, I hope we got some photos of him. He was so brilliant. The respect he had, he knew dad was the big man of the family, because Fluffy was never allowed in the house. But occasionally, when we'd all be sitting in the front room, we'd let him in, and he would come very, very sort of cautiously. He'd sit down next to dad and be on his like best behavior, as in like, thank you, I really appreciate this. You know, I won't mess around, yeah. That sort of thing. But I remember, literally, as we were about to get in the car, mum said to me, go and give Fluffy some, one of his favorites was bread just soaked in milk. So she gave me a bowl and she said, go and give this to Fluffy. And I went over to him, and normally as I'd go to his, he had this like massive cage, he'd be like barking and yelping. And it's like, you know, come on, are we going to let me out? Going to play and all that sort of thing. And I'm not joking, he just sat there. He sat there and looked at me. And I thought, that's really strange. I opened the cage. Normally, I'd have to make sure he doesn't run out, because he'd run out into the street and stuff. And he just sat there. He was like, he had this look as if, it's like, so you're going to leave. You know, it's that sort of thing. That was it. Floods. Don't want to go. Don't care about the plane. I'm not leaving Fluffy. And he just sat there and looked at me so sad, because he knew. I mean, I'm sure he knew. So Fluffy is a big, big memory there, a very, very good memory. But I remember when we left there, yeah, it was exciting. I don't think we had major problems actually from going from the house to the airport, because a lot of families did have.
Yeah.
They were stopped. my mama, Bharat mama, who passed away a few months ago, I know they didn't let him on. They let Ba, my mummy, and others on, and they didn't let him on. And it was a touch and go thing. So I don't think we did, but I may be wrong there.
What was the reason they didn't let him on?
They just wanted to hassle people, but also they were after money.
Yeah.
So if they hassled people in the hope that they'd be offered money. And it was just a random thing for them, I think. It was like, you know, who do we think we can get money from? Mm. You know, if we stop, if a car's going somewhere and we stop them, it's like a roadblock. It's an impromptu roadblock. They're going to offer us some money to let us go on our way. So this was going, people carried around bundles of cash.
Yeah.
On the way to the airport, people were wearing all the jewellery they could to take with them. And they were offering this jewellery to the army people. Wow. So it turned nasty. But people are doing this as a way of saving their lives. When we came here, I remember the first thing I noticed. So your dad picked us up. And from the airport to, I think, his house was in Totteridge. I remember the first thing I noticed is I saw rows of houses all the same. And I've never seen two houses the same. Not even two houses the same in Jinja. So I just saw hundreds of these houses all the same. And I thought, that's a big house. I didn't realise they were all separate houses. We went to your dad's place. We freshened up. And then I think it's on the same day, literally in a couple of hours, we went to the shop to pick up the keys. So the guy, I think his name was George Coates. It's strange, I remember these things. We literally went there and he handed the keys over to my dad. And I don't know if that was a Saturday or a Sunday, but on the Monday, Dad opened the shop. So between leaving the shop in Jinja, I think there was at most 2 days where Dad opened the shop in Barking, Londis. We would have been probably the second or third person, Indian, to have a Londis here, I believe. I think a good friend of your dad's, Balu, was probably the first. So the transition for us was, I mean, we've got to be thankful. There were no refugee camps involved. We were able to have, you know, go from one business to another. But in the end, I think the worry and the hard work took its toll on Dad.
Yeah.
There was a lot of responsibility. I mean, for us, we can't even begin to imagine the worry that our parents went through at the time to actually leave everything and start again. We couldn't bring a lot over. It's literally what you can carry and what you could fit into trunks. And then we had the worry of Vinonko and his family and Prakashanko and Ba being there and the situation getting worse and worse. And it's not like being able to phone every day. It's a case of just hoping and praying that they're okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, thankfully, with the grace of God, that they all made it over here. And that was a big relief. That was a massive relief then. But that's when we think, you know, how lucky we were, because we had a business that, okay, it's hard work, but we could, you know, we needed people to come and help with the business, but at least we had one, because so many families were just in refugee camps.
Yeah.
That can't have been fun. So the transition there was a bit harsh, even for me, because suddenly it's like, well, none of my friends are here. I've got this shop. And bearing in mind, we could speak, you know, I learned English at Victoria Nile, but our English was pretty much the Queen's English there, because there was no accents. Suddenly I've come into the middle of the East End where these guys are talking in a complete Cockney accent, and I thought it was foreign. I couldn't understand what they were saying, you know.
So that's still here today.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, I had to adapt very quickly, you know, try and make friends. I didn't want to go out. I found it very, very strange. I just wanted to sit in the shop. And Mum and Dad said at the time, said, no, you can't do that. You've got to go out and make friends.
Why do you think that was? Do you think it's because there's a huge contrast in the way life was between Jinja and the UK, or something more personal?
No, I think it was just seeing so much difference.
Yeah.
I was so used to the comfort of the way people interacted in Jinja, the way the friends were. Because their friends and family and everything, it all rolled into one. It was that there weren't any boundaries, really. All my friends at school all the parents knew each other, either through the shop or from the ginger club and that sort of thing. Suddenly to come here where there's so many more people that you don't know that talk in a different way, they react in a different way. And that's the first time I came across racism. Mm. So this was in, what, 72. And racism was rife. That's in the days of the skinheads. When people were calling me Paki and Wog and stuff like that, I didn't even know what that meant.
Right.
I guessed it was derogatory because just from the expression on their faces. I got into a few scraps quite early on and I realized that, you know, we need to change the way we behave here. And often Satin was with me. So, you know, I had to make sure that he's safe as well because he was 5 years younger than me. He was a kid. But in a residential estate in Barking, it's definitely deep end there.
Yeah.
It's definitely deep end. It's baptism by fire. You have to get to know how to look after yourself, or you just don't go out. And mum and dad weren't having any of this. And I'm really grateful that they encouraged us to integrate. Whatever it is out there, that's what's out there. There's no choice. It's not like, you know, if you walk outside the shop, it's the estate, right? You're going to have to integrate. You're going to have to make friends. And we did. And we learned a way. Do you know what? The thing is that was a working class estate, a proper working class estate. Most people there worked at Dagenham Fords. Probably to this day, some of the genuinely nicest people I've met. There was some that were racist, but also you have to give them a little bit of leeway as well because they just hadn't come across coloured people before, you know? Maybe from far, but suddenly the local supermarket is run by Indians. Mm. And these people were a little bit shocked. They didn't know how to handle it, you know? And as soon as they realised, but, oh, hang on, they speak English, they know what we're talking about, and they changed. So that barrier came down for a lot of people. So as bad as it was when it first started, it got very good. You know, we saw the good side of it very, very quickly. And some great friends there, really, really nice people.
Was it hard to integrate with the students in school?
Yeah, that was a bit tougher because you had to, like, for instance, at the shop, you know, you could go outside when you wanted to, you could come back if it just got too much. Whereas at school, suddenly, I remember Dad dropped me off at Barking Abbey Comprehensive School one morning, and he gave me a handful of change. He said, you'll need this. And I thought, well, okay, I don't really know what to, you know, money didn't mean a great deal to me at the time. I sort of found out quickly that you needed change for your dinner money and stuff like that. I think it was 12p for dinner. So the first thing is I remember getting pushed around quite a bit on the first day, the very first day I remember getting pushed around with the racism side of things. And I thought, I either just step back and I could get pushed around forever, or I'm going to have to retaliate. I chose to retaliate. I think that was a good thing.
Okay.
Got a pasting a couple of times, gave it a few times as well. And that way people thought, okay, he's not going to just sort of take a slap every time. And again, I met the nicest people that I'm still in touch with there. It was tough. But I'll tell you what, the education I got at Barking Abbey was fantastic. If you wanted to learn, it was there. The teachers were superb. School life was actually good. It wasn't quite ginger. But then also, I remember that the teachers were caring. They did care about how you picked up, how you learned, how well you were doing, and that sort of thing. I don't know what it's like it now, but my memories of school were good. It was just a difficult start.
And what were the expectations like? The way you describe schooling in Jinja, obviously the teachers and parents often shared a friendly relationship. And so anything that you did at school tended to go back to the parents quite quickly. Did you find that was very different when you studied here?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so much that, although, you know, there were reports on that. I think here it depended on, for me, it depended on who the circle of friends were. So initially, my circle of friends were Chuck the Lads. And yeah, you know, I was one of them. Luckily, that moved. I've moved on to another bunch of guys who were into their studies, and I got back into it more in that way. But in terms of, I mean, Dad always encouraged academia. He always sort of had this, he was never pushy, but he always asked and he could help me with my homework and stuff like that. So there was always that side of it. And I felt that I could do that for something as well, because, you know, he'd pick up something. So it was like, it was a subtle encouragement in that way. But certainly we'd lost that linkage that the parents had with the teachers. That wasn't the same. It was more down to the individual by the time we came here, because it was a big school.
And did expectations change from the uncles and your mum and dad when it came to going to school and the social element and even doing well?
I don't remember. I can't recall if there were ever any obvious expectations like that until about, for the first few years, certainly, it was a case of just getting along.
Yeah. You know?
Then as it came more towards O levels and the chat of the discussion on further education, then there was a little bit more expectations, mainly from mum and dad. And it was a case of, you know, you need to be thinking about this. But then I wanted to talk about it as well, because you think, well, I've got no idea what I want to do, really. I know that all I knew is that I was quite good at maths, but what does that mean, you know? So there was a lot of chat then, and obviously things like, you know, have you considered accountancy and stuff like that? It was that sort of thing. But we had, you know, there were other cousins I could talk to, so it was good in that way. And the friend circle was quite good. But I think it was a healthy sort of underlying expectation from family that it's a case of we go along with education, we don't drop it. And I don't think any of us did. And it was like it wasn't an upfront in your face type of expectation. It was an underlying thing. That's what we do, you know, which is nice. It sort of steers you in the right direction subconsciously.
Did you guys have the freedom to choose your own path when it came to what you wanted to do? Things I hear about their generation was there were kind of only fixed routes that you go down, you know, engineering or accountancy. But when it came to you guys, did you feel they're a bit more free or liberal to let you guide your own future?
I mean, I was always sort of science-based anyway, but I think I'm quite sure that had I wanted to go down, the arts route, Dad would have encouraged me.
Okay.
He would have been okay with that. Yeah. Dad had a the same calmness as Bapuji. I remember Bapuji when if I was playing up a bit in Jinja, he would say, "Upinaya." So he'd have his room upstairs, you know, someone would take up in there. And I'd be fine with him for hours, you know, and he had that warmth and calmness in him. I remember once Bapuji said, like, I didn't want to eat. All I want, because my staple diet was rotli with tomato sauce on it, which I've got to try again at some point because that's what I wanted to eat. So Bapuji said, "Chal, masate bes." And he managed to persuade me to try. And I was, what, 7 or 8 at the time? He persuaded me to try giri no tang. Not something that a kid really, it's not a kid's taste, you know?
It's strong taste.
And he managed to eat it just in the way he says things. He said, "Atraika." From that day on, it's been one of my favorites to this day. I'll always have giri no tang anywhere I go, right? And Dad had that same calmness in him. He smiled a lot. Some people say to me, "Oh, Jenti Bai Jo Lagat," you know, and I know I look like him. I know my mannerisms are like him, and I'll take it as a massive compliment. But someone also said to me that you don't smile as much as Jenti Bai, which, fair enough, he had a smile on his face at the time. I remember one episode, I was into percussion. I learned to play the drums. I actually learned to read music, percussion music, when I was at school. My teacher said, you should consider this as, you know, go to music school or something like that. And Dad said, well, okay. He said, you're going to need to practice. So he said, how are you going to practice? I said, well, how about I get a drum kit? You know, this is in sort of mid-70s, you know. So I was saying to Dad, would you buy me a drum kit? And I wanted the full drum kit. I had some catalogs and all that sort of thing. And he said, all right. He goes, you can do this. He said, I'll get you a drum kit if you want. And he goes, he's seen the catalog open at one. He goes, you can have that one. But he goes, just bear in mind that you're going to have to practice every day. And if the neighbors complain, you're probably going to have to stop. He goes, there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, he goes, or I'll buy you any hi-fi that you want, because I was into hi-fi as well. And this is from Prakash Uncle and Ashir Uncle, and you know, and your dad was, yeah. You know, he had some hi-fi shops, you know. So we had this interest, and it wasn't just a passing interest. I knew what units, like, you know, what the latest turntables are, the ones that suddenly they came out with strobes and stuff like that. So Dad had a subtle way of getting me, you know, onto different tracks or the sensible track. And he said, don't give up your drums, but I'll, you know, if you want to, and I did. I said, all right, I'll go for a hi-fi. He goes, choose anyone you want and I'll buy it. And Sutton still, I think he still uses a couple of the units that we bought in those days. So he had a calmness about him that would help me in the right direction if needed. But I do believe that if I'd have said, no, I definitely want to go for music, he would have said, yeah. I don't think, he would have been concerned, okay. But I don't think he would have stopped me.
Yeah, they're all really encouraging. We do have quite a high-tech set of uncles, don't we? It's always kind of carried on to our generation as well. And then what was the transition like actually working life here? Was it as you would have expected or was it quite a shock?
Yeah, I mean, that was about the time that Dad passed away. So I remember I just started, it was, university was probably some of the best days of my life. And I guess it's that way for a lot of people. My university group, we're still in touch, and it still feels like this group always looking out for each other and that sort of thing. And I'm sure that's the case with you and the cousins as well. But going from university to work, my first job was for ICL in Bracknell. That's where the jobs were. By that time, Dad was not well.
Okay.
He'd had a heart attack. We'd given up the shop, so they'd moved over to here because Bharat Mama and Jan Mama and Shish Mama, they were able to sort of keep an eye on him. And give him, you know, assistance whenever needed. So he moved over to this way. I think Mum was a bit disappointed that I didn't get a job around here, but it was difficult at the time. You know, we were sort of trying to get, you know, we were looking at salaries, who were offering the best and that sort of thing. And ICL came up, so I went there. But I used to come over here at weekends, pretty much almost every weekend. In terms of working life there, I don't remember that being particularly tough. It was just a case of we'd been living at university, you know, away from home, apart from weekends anyway. So this was just you're out of university digs into your own place or a rented place with friends. And to start with, I was with people from my university anyway. And I was enough into sports at the time, so you know, you make friends. We had a great all the graduates together at ICL, a big company. We all got together, we got to know each other. So I didn't find that transition difficult at all. But then it was only about a year into that, about 2 or 3 years into that, that Dad passed away, and that was sudden. So yeah, that was a shock.
By this point, did you, you know, when you're going into university, did you feel you had settled in to the way of life of the country by this point? Do you feel you had integrated and you felt part of the UK by this point?
Oh, that happened well before that. I think the shock of environment, culture, language, even weather, from Ginger to to barking, let's say, was so dramatic that it elicited something quite, it needed some dramatic action in me. And I changed very quickly. And that happened, I would say, within months, actually. Within months, it was a case of learn or get left behind. Just learn to adapt quickly on how you behave, how you interact. And you had to sort of drop some of the things that you knew and had been like for many, many years and adapt a new way of even talking. Because otherwise, you'd just be an outsider. So that part happened very, very quickly. And by the time, within 6 months at school, I was one of the boys, you know. And school was very much like that. Sutton was at the same school as well. And I had to be one of the boys because I wanted to make sure that Sutton was okay as well.
Yeah. So there's a real sink or swim mindset that you had to take on, really.
Very much, yeah. So by the time university came, it was, you know, going to university, suddenly freedom. We got money, digs. Okay, you had to work. But it was okay. It was nice. I liked this such great, you know. I think the thing that got me at university was suddenly you're with people who want to learn.
Yeah.
Because by that time, I think the separation at school was obvious. There were, by the time you're at 15, 16, you're either with the people that want to learn or you're with the people that can't wait for compulsory school to be over and they can go and work in a shop. And I was with the people that wanted to learn. But when you get to university, everyone's like that and you can relax. And it was really good.
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah, you touched on Dad's passing, but if you haven't mentioned it already, what was your fondest memory of him?
I think when I used to come home from university, I remember Mum used to have a go because I would come home. Sometimes we'd come home. Dad would often pick me up at the station. We'd come home, we'd sit down, and after 2 hours, Mum would come in the front room and say, "Upin, at least gortokar." You know, I'd be sitting there. I'd have my coat, everything, my hold all would be next to the sofa. And I'd just be chatting to Dad. We'd talk about cricket, maybe about politics, but anything about university, work, whatever it was, it would just be, we were so alike, I think. I think the connection I had with Dad was, we didn't really need to communicate that much, but when we talked, there was just so much. The link was very, very strong. That's what I had with Dad. And Mum would often say, you know, at least like, you know, take your coat off, sit, you know, have some tea or stuff like that. I remember he used to joke sometimes. He'd ring me up and he goes, "Right." So he goes, you coming on this weekend?" I'd say, "Yeah." He goes, "All right. When Mum asks what you'd like to eat," you know, because she'd always make something special if I was coming, he goes, "Can you tell her this?" You know, because that would be what he wanted. You know? it was a joke. But he would, you know, occasionally he'd say, like, you know, "Do you fancy a drink?" We'd go to the pub, have a drink, and I thought it was fantastic. That was very progressive in those days, that you could go for a drink, even though I was old enough, but you could go for a drink with your dad. I never smoked in front of him. I don't know if you knew, I think he didn't know that I smoked then. I don't think he even said much to me. Mum used to sort of say to me, you know, you should pack up, but I never smoked in front of them. I didn't smoke in front of Mum till I was about 33.
Was that out of respect?
Yeah. It was just respect. But I remember, like we had the big house in Ginger where it was the central place, that was also like what our house was in Ilford. And it was lovely. It was wonderful. The fact that we had so many people that used to come over. Like, it then Lina only in school holidays would come over, so it was a central place where Dad used to in the evening when if Prakash uncle was here during his holidays or for a while when he worked in the shop and Ashwin uncle, if they came home on their way from the shop to their houses, they'd all sit and have a beer. But they wouldn't have the beer, the can of beer. They would make sure that Bar didn't see that. Right? So although Bar knew that they were all having a beer, I think it was different for Dad. He'd have a beer and he'd have it on his stool. But Ashwin Uncle and Prakash Uncle would have the newspaper in front of the can of beer. And they used to laugh because I used to think this was very funny, because when they wanted a drink, they'd raise the newspaper and they'd have the can. They'd take a slug out of the can. And I used to think this was very funny. But out of respect, they wouldn't do it directly in front of Bar. So that was just something that I think is good. It's a good thing.
No, that's true. I mean, even by my point, I've always seen our, especially the uncles, but those siblings in general as very progressive, even compared to when I speak to some of my friends about their parents. I was always a lot more, and I think they had to be because they came here so early, but they've adapted so much more to being modern within the kind of culture that we live in, which has always been nice, I think. Again, we show the same respect, but even with that progressive side, it's good to hear that they still had that level of respect for their own parents.
I think in that way, respect in the Dattani family, that's always been there. I can't think of anything, any behavior that's been outwardly disrespectful at any level. I think that's always been there, but there's been a healthy level of progressiveness that, you know, we don't get stuck behind. It's not like we're in the dark ages or thing. I think it's been a very, very good mix. And I remember the closeness between my dad and my uncle was there was a very, very strong bond there, incredibly strong, actually. My uncle would come around so often with Linai only. And sometimes it would be just like with no notice. It would be like Saturday, they turn up. And it was like, great, you know, it was really nice, because that means that for me and Satin and Lina and Omni, we get to spend a couple of days together just messing about. Vinoncle and Dad would just chat, and we'd have everyone would be there in the house, and that was so nice. And Vinoncle used to look up to Dad. That was obvious. And I think when Dad went, Vinoncle lost a mentor. And he felt it.
They've always been very close, and it's something that I admire a lot. And I think that's helped us cousins, even though, especially now, we don't really get to see each other. But a lot of us, we didn't see each other for a while. But as soon as we got together, it was never difficult to find things to talk about or relate to each other or just have a good time. And I think that, for me, that's very much come from how they've always been. And it's kind of been passed down to us. If there was one key lesson or message that your dad taught you, what would you say that's been?
I don't know if there's one particular. I think, there is one, and that's just fairness. I think what I saw in the way that Dad behaved, it was like a kindness and a fairness and compassion. I think that's how I saw him behaving to the whole of the family, all the brothers, the sisters. I mean, he almost had to be like a father, to the younger, you know, to Prakash Uncle and Ashwin Uncle, and especially Minafe and Sobofe. You know, he had to get them, you know, get them onto their next stage of life, of the married life. So he had to do that. But there was always the compassion, and that's what I saw with Dad, and that's how he was with me and Satin. Even when he was ill, you know, there was, I would say, yeah, kindness, fairness, and compassion is something that I learned from Dad. I mean, there's so much that we talked about that sort of settles in, and it's there as a guidance, but there's tons of that.
Yeah, that's really nice. And before we move on to the final five, is there anything that we haven't talked about either with regards to your life or Mum, Dad's life, or even Bar Bapuji that you'd like to mention?
I think it's worth just mentioning, like when my memories of, say, Sanjay is slightly different. When he was first born, I think soon after he was born, Minafay stayed with us in our house in Ilford. And I remember rushing home from school whenever I could so I could play with Sanjay. And my image is he'd be lying down in his sort of like a mattress in the front room, and Sanjay had happy eyes, and he would just smile so easily. And all he had to do was just go over him and say, "Hello, Sanjay," you know, and his legs would kick. And that's something that we all remember so much, because if you got close to him and went over him and you made him laugh, he'd be kicking you. You'd receive a few kicks. And I remember that so well about Sanjay. And I think it's a shame that I didn't get to meet him so much afterwards. It was only a few times, you know. But I just remember the happy eyes he had. Nice memories to have. But this is, you know, this is why I say sometimes I fill in the middle, because it's almost like sometimes I could regard people like Sanjay. Nita, I remember when, like, Nita was a, you know, young kid.
Yeah.
And it's almost like being my, that's why I say you're all my baby brothers and sisters, because you are. I remember she used to come around a lot, so she spent a lot of time with us. And she had this unique way of coming down the stairs. She'd slide on her bum and navigate, or she'd control the speed of descent with one leg and stuff like that. These are great memories, you know. There's a couple of things, things that you said are probably not for the video, but I'll tell you another time.
I look forward to it. We can do a part two just for the family. That's awesome. I've learned so much from that. It's been really insightful. And so I always want to end with these five questions on stuff we haven't really talked about. So firstly, a nice and easy one. What was your favorite book or movie and why?
Do you know what? I haven't actually thought about that. My favorite book is easily, it's by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, and it's called The Shadow of the Wind. It's like an adult sort of fairy tale. It's got all the elements in it. It's got a little bit of magic, but it's got some romance in it, some excitement. I recommend everyone I've recommended to Shadow of the Wind, they've loved it. I'm not sure if I can say much more on why. And I've just gone on to read every book he's written. The original has always been written in Spanish, but the translation is fantastic. So worth it.
Yeah, I've never heard it.
Yeah.
At the beginning, you mentioned a number of times about how great life was in Jinjiang and you'd love to go back. If you had the chance to live there again, would you do that?
I'd jump to it. Wow. It's that attachment to where you're born.
Yeah.
That doesn't go away. It's so strong. I don't know. And it's funny because there's these Facebook groups now about, I think there's a group that I'm part of, this Ugandan Asians or something like that. And just today or yesterday, someone posted a load of stuff about Jinjiang. And I go through it with a big, big smile, even seeing what it's like today. And I can sometimes see myself, you know, I could easily live there because I understand the smells and the colours and the place. You know, I'm sure it would be different. I'm sure, you know, I've got that thing. Oh, hang on, I don't remember this. But the underlying attachment, that doesn't go.
Mm.
I mean, recently I got one of the girls that was at school with me, a Dutch girl. She contacted me on Facebook, I think it was. She's in Holland, and I went over to see her, and we both talked about Jinjiang, and she said, she goes, when all this happened with Amin, they had to leave as well. And she said she went from playing around in red dirt in her flip-flops to going to a Dutch boarding school. She goes, imagine the stark contrast in that, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, for me, I would do it.
Yeah, I love that. So one of the reasons for calling this series The Journey Onwards is the idea that also the stories themselves can carry on to live through the generations. And given that you've seen a lot of us grow up, do you have any favorite stories of our generation of cousins?
Yeah, there is one that springs to mind. And this is based in Auntie Helma's kindergarten that we all went to, myself, Satin, Lina and Alni. Now, Alni was like, she would stick to Satin like it was like a hero and a probably a torturer at times, but she loved him. You know, she was just, she wouldn't leave his side, especially at kindergarten. And whatever he would do, whether it was good or he was getting into trouble, she would be next to him. And I think one of the things that Auntie Helma used to do is that if you were naughty, you had to spend, I don't know, 5-10 minutes in the bathroom. She'd lock you in the bathroom.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't that much of a deal. I think we all went through it a couple of times. Something probably more than most, but he did. So he'd done something. He probably said something or chucked water over someone. And he had to, Auntie Helma said, right, you've got to go in the bathroom. So she's put him in the bathroom, only cried and made such a scene, so much. But the only way to stop her was that she insisted on going to the bathroom with him. Right? So Auntie Helma had to put Auntie and Satin in the bathroom. When the time came to release, Satin just casually strolls out thinking, right, that's my time done. Auntie couldn't stroll out because he'd wrapped her up in toilet roll like a mummy from head to toe.
Oh my
he
God.
Just used every toilet roll he could find. And wrapped her. She just stood there, quite happy, not complaining. But I thought that was a great brother sister moment for them. That was his way of showing his love for her.
Yeah, this is great. I'm going to be speaking to Avni in the near future as well, so I'm definitely going to see if she remembers it. Which I'm sure she has some other fun stories as well. That's great. We've always been quite a mischievous family as well, and it's something that I loved about us as well. And do you have any particular funny stories or memories of some of the other, the tiny siblings of the our parents' generation?
Yeah. This is at the time of the shop. So in the London shop, we had Usher and Uncle there. I mean, Christmas Eve was probably the biggest day for the shop in terms of business. We'd take a lot in it. It was very, very busy. So we had a parade of shops. And at the end of that day, we would go around, all the shopkeepers would go around to one shop and we'd just have a load of drinks. There'd be beers, we'd have crisps and stuff like that, and a lot of liqueur. So I remember this one time, Usher and Uncle said to me, we had this girl, this lady who worked in our shop called Lynn. And Usher and Uncle said to me, he said, let's try and get Lynn drunk, you know, in this sort of hour or 2 hours. So we kept on filling a glass up with whiskey. And every time she said, no, she goes, I'll just have some ginger ale, you know. So we'd do that. When she wasn't looking, we'd fill it up with whiskey. She could barely walk out the shop after 2 hours. She was a big, big lady, lovely, lovely person. And she could barely walk out the shop. And a couple of days later, her husband came and said, thanks, guys, but we had a pretty ruined Christmas dinner because Lynn was in no state to cook.
That's amazing.
So we thought, yep, job done. And then the next year, she said, right, I'm not having any of this. I'm not drinking any more whiskey. So she shouldn't have told us that, basically. So all afternoon, so what can we do? So we thought, I know what. We'll fill the ginger ale bottle up with whiskey so we can just feed her that all the time. So all evening, we said, no, no whiskey for you, Lynn. We're just putting more and more ginger ale in it. She was even in a worse state. Plan worked superbly. Les came and said, thanks, boys. Sandwiches for Christmas dinner again. There were some good times in that shop. We had some fun. Worked hard, but things like that we remember quite well. Usher and Uncle will definitely remember that. It was a good plan.
Yeah, work hard, play hard, I think is a motto that we've kind of always lived by.
Yeah, good stories. Plenty more when we got time.
I look forward to them. You touched on it already, but how would you describe Ba and Bapuji in 3 words?
Loving, caring, protective.
Is that for both of them?
Both of them.
So they both instilled the same characteristics and the way they were?
Definitely. We are what we are today because of Ba and Bapuji. That's what they instilled in all their children, a sense of family. And That's why we're all talking today. It's so important. I really, really believe that the reason that we all enjoy getting together, you know, like for instance, the last time that a lot of us got together that I can remember was, for instance, Amit's birthday. Mm. You know, where a lot of us got together.
Yeah, yeah.
We all enjoy doing that so much because of the way we are, and we are the way we are because of Bhavan Bapuji.
Love that. Couldn't agree more. What advice would you give to a 20 or 30 year old version of yourself?
I would say spend more time with family.
Yeah. So when you were in Jinja, would you say family was the center of the way life was lived? I mean, you know, now there's the society that I live in, it's kind of career and family and friends, and it's all important. You have to work on all areas and people want to be good at all of them. But do you feel life in Jinja was family was always at the epicenter and then everything came after?
Definitely, 100%. Because, for instance, you know, lunchtime, everyone had lunch together. It was all done as a family. Cooking was together because we, like most families, we were one big joint family under one roof. So all of that happened together. Family was definitely the central thing for us. Yeah, you know, even though, for instance, you know, Bapuji had so much going on in the community. You know, he gave so much to the community, and he was a central figure there. But he always made sure that the family was there and kept together and in the right direction.
That's really nice. And a bonus question that I'm asking everyone, what do you think makes our family special?
I think it's because I don't think we're too concerned about competition. I think we put family before wealth. That's a very direct term.
Yeah. But it's also what splits many families apart, right?
Yeah. And I think there's enough looking out for each other. That was the case in Bhavan Bapuji's time, and that's been passed on to our parents. And I'm sure it's something that we've picked up,
yeah,
you know, in our generation. And if there was something that I would say that's worth us passing on to our nieces and nephews, then that would be a good one. That would be a very good one.
I think you're right, because even that's got me thinking that, you know, even amongst the cousins, we kind of all want the other ones to do well, but there's never a sense of ego or jealousy or anything that plays onto one of the other ones doing well.
I think, yeah, the ego, yes, ego is probably a better term than wealth, I think. We put family before ego.
Yeah, I love that. That's
really cool. Because when it matters, everyone comes in. I think that's what makes us different.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be going forward. And I think this last year has probably made that stronger for us. I'm sure we all realize it.
For sure. Yeah, that's amazing. That's a really nice way to finish it. Thank you so much for that. That was a really, really good insight. And I'm sure there's still so much more we can cover. And if it comes to it, we'll do a part two. More than happy to carry on this conversation again.
It's been really good. I can't remember the last time I spoke in any kind of structured way about this.
Yeah.
But it's lovely to go through it. If we, yeah, I've got some silly stories from the cousins. So if you've got time, I can do that whenever you're ready.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would be a kind of a spin-off. We'll do a younger generation's version of it. And I'm sure you'll play a lot into that. But, you know, especially being at the younger end of this generation, it's really, really interesting to hear some of these stories, because otherwise I've heard bits of it. But like you say, to kind of hear it in this structure has been amazing. So thanks.
I think it's a great thing. I really look forward to what the result of all of this. So I hope you get as many people as possible contributing.
Me too.
Cool. Cheers, Alan. Cheers.